previously on Debug with David Gelfman.
Peter Graffanino, who was one of the next people that came over, he had been a graphics guy at Next. He was the person that I remember people at Adobe working with, among others, on the Next software, you know, when they were doing Display PostScript. And Peter, who was, I think, just super brilliant person, you know, we had gotten an offer from Apple. Apple basically said, hey, we're not going to be able to continue to pay you contracting dollars. You're like the number one contractor dollar-wise, saying to RBI. We want you to come and work for us instead of work as contractors. And that's what we ended up doing. Was, not everybody, but most of the people on the team came to Apple as employees in June of 2000.
And now?
And I quickly found just amazing group of people in the graphics team. There's the people that worked on the Windows Server 2D graphics. There's ColorSync, which was integrated into Quartz 2D. You know, QuickDraw was part of that team, but you know, QuickDraw was sort of, you know, just keep it going. You know, was sort of what QuickDraw was at that point. Peter later acquired Quartz Composer software, PixelShox, which got integrated into macOS. He was, I think, sort of the person behind compositing Windows Server. I don't mean he wrote all the code. I mean the notion of having a Windows Server and having it be a compositing Windows Server, which was a really daring move.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
so amazing. So when they yanked Display PostScript, the thing that I did love was the compositing Windows Server, because that was a huge bet. And but it, like I was writing video games at the time, and you could see how that was a bet on the way that GPUs, accelerated texture blitters, basically were going, where you'd render client side into your texture, you'd upload the texture or just what changed from the texture, and then be able to composite it on the card. And in 2000, that didn't fully pan out.
Well, that wasn't the way it worked in 2000. You know, it took a while before they really had it.
But you could see, so from having done GPU programming, I could see like, well, this is the way it's going. This just makes total sense. And I think that was a real good bet on, you know, it was one of those skate to where the puck is going sort of moments.
I absolutely agree with you, Guy. I absolutely. You know, and I think there was a lot of that. I really do. And, Peter was partly behind Core Animation, which has turned out to be a huge thing for both iOS and also on Mac OS X.
Core Animation is kind of the next logical step from the compositing Windows Server in a way.
Yeah. And just his team, you know, he had 2D graphics on his team, 3D graphics, you know. He had acquired a 3D graphics company that did GL graphics and brought them in to the company. And that's where the 3D, you know, prior to that, there was QuickDraw 3D. You know, and they got GL graphics and QuickDraw 3D was, you know, deprecated pretty quickly, you know. It was a pretty amazing, you know, technology and people, you know, when I first got to Apple. By the way, it still is. I first arrived, it was really very different than working. And by the way, I work with a lot of really smart, good people at RBI. It's just, this is the people, you know, at Apple. It's just another level, totally. And, you know, we came in because the printing team, such as it was at the time, they needed help. And we knew a lot about printing. So we basically ended up becoming the printing team over time. And that's what I was doing primarily at Apple during my years at Apple. It ended up, because I was the graphics guy on the printing team for the most part, I did a lot of core graphics work. It was this... When I look back over my career, you know, I sort of was thinking about talking with you guys, and I look back at my career, I was like, all of this sort of just came together right at the time that I started at Apple, because I, you know, had this great background in PostScript, great background in the PostScript PDF imaging model. And here we had, you know, basically that graphic system was the graphic system on the Mac. And we got to build the printing system around that. So, you know, the metafile format for the printing system, instead of being picked, which is what it had been in the old OS 8 days or whatever. It was now PDF. So just making PDFs out of printing was like a standard part of printing.
Brilliant. Yeah. Save as PDF is one of my favorite features, actually.
It is. And, you know, there's some other things that got added over time. You know, Rich, who's, you know, came over to Apple at the time I did, you know, he added this sort of PDF workflow stuff where you can, mm-hmm. you know, send your PDFs through from the printing system off to other applications. Not, you know, like some of them are built-in ones like Mail or whatever, but you can build a workflow where the PDF from the printing system gets sent to you and you can do something with it, you know. So it was pretty cool. So, you know, I arrived at Apple and, you know, they needed help in the stuff related to PostScript generation for the new graphic system, which was the perfect fit for me. I knew, you know, using CG immediately was just straightforward, partly because it's a great API. Derek Clegg, who's really pretty much the person responsible for that at Apple, really good API designer, and it's a very clean, very well done API. And so I did a lot of code related to CG, that used CG internally, and some code for CG also in the core graphic system. And, you know, I thought, if you're interested, I'll tell you a little bit of sort of about how my book came about, because I ended up...
Yeah, I was just going to say, you're the guy that wrote the book on the CG API, just to set you up anyway. So.
Well, you know, I was actually pretty dissatisfied with the documentation at Adobe, that, I'm sorry, too many A's in here, that Apple was doing for the Core Graphics API. You know, especially in the early 2000s, I felt like, you know, the document, you know, coming out of a DTS world from Adobe and really having I come from a developer-focused sort of point of view a lot. And so I looked at documentation. I'm like, there's not enough. Yeah. And
it was standard to joke about it. What was it? Description forthcoming. It was like,
yeah, you know,
the most common,
yeah,
common description for a method. Yeah.
Well, do you feel like that's the case today?
No, I think they do a terrific job today.
Yeah, so, you know, what happened, I think, is...
I mean, there's obviously spotty areas, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, nobody's going to say everything's perfect, but I think it's changed a lot, and part of that is just through Apple's success that they've put more focus on the API, on the documentation, mm-hmm. you know. But I didn't feel like that was the case at that point. And really what happened is that coming over from outside Apple was a book that a third party was writing, working with O'Reilly. And they asked us at Apple to take a look at it and give some feedback on the book. And so somebody gave it to me because I'm sort of a weenie in this way. I'd worked a lot with the documentation people at mm-hmm. Apple on the printing docs and just in docs in general, and also feedback on the core graphics documentation. But I looked at what this person was doing with the book, and I'm like, I didn't like it. It just, for me, wasn't what I would like to see. And I gave that feedback, and I'm just like thinking, well, why try and help somebody make a book that, you know, is the right book? Why put all that effort in? Why not just, stupidly, I thought, why not just write the book?
Right.
You know, and I have to give just a tremendous amount of credit to the management at Apple for letting me do that.
Really notable that a developer on a pretty important system was actually writing a book about it. I thought so, that was...
Is that the way it was perceived outside Apple? I have no idea.
To me, it was, because I happen to know that you worked there. And it's uncommon for people to communicate in that kind of way. It's not like you spill any beans, right?
No. That was very carefully, that was carefully crafted to not do so. I can tell you a little bit about that if you're interested, but I mean, it wasn't to write the inside story of how to use core graphics, you know, if you weren't using public API. It wasn't anything like that. It was how to use the public API. What was the imaging model? How to use the public API? How to solve specific problems that people have? That's what it was for me. That's the way I looked at it. And Bunny Layton, who...
must-have reference book.
I'm
trying to plug it for everybody. Just everybody
go
out and buy
it. I appreciate that. It's a little long in the tooth because it was published at the end of 2005. And so
everything about the imaging model is still dead on.
All of that's still there, and there's still code that's useful. I mean, yeah, it has legs longer than maybe some books would. But, you know, obviously, if you're going to update it, there would be a lot of material. You know, this was in 2005. This is right at the time that Intel-based Macintoshes were hitting the market. It was well before the iPhone and iPad. It was a different world.
The particulars of using like a CG layer may not be as important these days or have the same sort of effect. Right. But the concepts are all still the same. You know what I mean? I think if you read that book and understand how this stuff works, then when you see new stuff, you can understand how that works.
Well, that's good you feel that way, because that was certainly the goal of, but you know, the goal was to not, I didn't want to write like one of these books where you build a fake application and try and, I don't know. That's what that other book was, and I didn't like it. I'd like the idea of, here are the concepts and here's some code. Here's how you write the code, you know, to do specific things. And the specific things are real world tasks that people need to do, like render to bits and then do something with those bits and that kind of stuff. You know, so I do want to say a little bit about Bunny and a little bit about how the book came about, because Bunny Layden, who's the co-author of the book with me, Bunny is somebody who I had worked with she worked in the documentation group and was terrific. And I had worked with her on the printing documentation, and that, you know, I was the person representing the printing team in terms of how the API worked and so on. And, you know, as Bunny was working on drafts or whatever, I worked with her, and she was just unbelievable in terms of both her writing skill and also her, just how great she is to work with. You know, I would, you know, make all kinds of comments about stuff that I didn't like about some piece of documentation she'd done. And I wasn't mean about it. I just, this wasn't right, or this, you know, whatever. And, you know, there's some people who get defensive about that. And Bunny is not at all that way. She'd just like, take it, great. This is great information. She'd turn it and it was great. You know, and so when I had the chance to work with her on the book, it's the only way that I would actually work on that, to do that book, was to do it with her. Now, what ended up happening, and I did, but what ended up happening is I somehow imagined this process would be like, you know, I would work with her on what, you know, how a given chapter, what was going to be in the chapter and so on and so forth. But I thought she was going to do most of the writing because she was the writer. But she didn't get the permission from her management to spend the kind of time on that book that I did. I don't want to say full time, but I got to spend a lot of time on that book, at least 3/4 of my time during the period of time I was working on it.
That's great.
Well, that's, you know, I had a really management chain. I was really lucky.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, let's just say it's the inverse from the experience I had working at Adobe, where the management chain maybe wasn't as easy to, you know, come up with a solution like that. They you know, Peter Graffinino and Rich Blanchard, who was my manager at the time, you know, they were like, yeah, do it. This is great. So I wrote most of the text in that book. And Bunny, who was just critical for you know, sort of organizing things better than I could organize them, really great ideas about some things to put in or take out or whatever. And, you know, once I wrote the prose to, you know, turn it into something, you know, better than it was when I wrote it. But I ended up writing a lot more than I expected to be honest. And I think if I'd known what it was going to take to do that book beforehand, I might not have taken it on, because it was a lot of work. But it was really satisfying. I mean, it was really sad. A UPS guy pulls up, or FedEx, FedEx, you know, brings the first copy of the book from the publisher, you know, from the print run. And that was an amazing experience to have that in my hands, because I thought they'd done a brilliant job of making it look nice.
Yep.
And just to have that, like, you know, after all that work, because it took a while.
Yeah. Well, it must be satisfying. It's like you put, after writing software for so many years, having something physical in your hands that you...
It's really different. And plus, it was really, you know, obviously a lot of people are involved in the final product for the book, because, you know, there's printing and there's formatting and there's all, you know, we didn't give them camera ready anything. They did the design and all of that. But it's much closer to, you know, OS, you know, Snow Leopard comes out. Yeah, you have a piece of that, you know. But this book came out, I had just, you know, enormous piece of it that was just me. And, you know, I was very pleased with it. And I got very good feedback, you know, people who read it, you know, I still get some nice comments from people about it because, well, it was an expensive book. I waited to buy it. I don't know why I waited to buy it. You know, now right. they got it. So, you know, how much it cost, that had nothing to do with me. But I do have a little story about how my name ended up being on that book because it wasn't going to be. Bunny and I, when we started that book, we weren't going to, that book was going to be author Apple. It wasn't going to happen on Amazon. We knew that. I mean, that was just, when Steve came back to Apple, that was the policy. Mm. You know, it was the same policy for the software, that there were no names anymore on programs that, within the OS, and, you know, all that stuff went away, right? And that's fine. I mean, I wasn't writing the book for people to know my name. I was writing the book because I wanted third parties to know how to program Quartz, you know, and, well, not just third parties, people within Apple too, but that's another matter.
Yeah.
And what happened is we got down to the very, very end. We're all done. Everything's turned in. All the artwork had been approved, we thought. And I thought we were all done. And then I guess they needed to have product marketing sign off on the cover. Now, the cover design for that book, it's got a crystal on it, which we had gone through a lot of different ideas for the cover or whatever, and came. Morgan Kaufman, the publisher, had come up with this really cool looking, what I thought was a really cool looking graphic of a crystal. So Quartz, that seemed like that sort of fit. And
do you know where that code name came from? I've never understood that.
That's a good question. I don't know.
I gotta find out.
I might be somebody, able to find out.
Yeah, somebody write in and tell me where Quartz came from. Anyway, sorry.
I'll be curious if somebody finds out. I mean, I know some people I could ask. I never actually asked that question. And you know, because internally it probably was a product marketing thing, because internally it was known as Core Graphics. You know, all of these things had their internal name, and then they decided to call it Quartz. I don't know where that came from. It was already called that when I got to Apple. So anyway, we're at the end of the line. I mean, I'm just like, oh, thank God we're all done. This is a big, you know, long project. And somebody in the product marketing group sent an email out. They were complaining. I said, what is that turkey drumstick graphic that you're talking about using for the cover? And I'm like, oh, God. And this is somebody I'd had some involvement with before who had never been helpful. And it just set off this whole, you know, we can't have it. Now all of a sudden the people in product marketing got involved because we can't have Apple's name associated with this thing that's not a perfect graphic, you know, it was that kind of thing.
You
can imagine, you know, when the publisher is trying to meet their deadline for publishing it, and for me, you know, after all this work, and Bunny and, you know, a lot of people were, and we had thought we'd had all this permission worked out. So anyway, the solution ended up being somebody, I assume it was Bertrand Serlet, went to Steve and said, you know, here's this problem. Can we put the names of the people who wrote the book on the cover so that it doesn't have to say it was authored by Apple? That was the solution. Okay? And the answer was okay. The answer, well, sorry, that bad choice of letters there, I guess. But
yeah.
the answer was yes. And of course, you know, I was thrilled, of course, to have my name on it. I mean, that turned out to be the solution to this hairy, intractable problem was fine with me.
Yeah.
And Bunny, you know, both of us were perfectly glad. But it was just funny that that was the way. To me, it was funny. It wasn't funny during the process, I'll say that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was funny by the time we got to the point of our names were going to be on it. Totally unexpected.
Yeah, it's like the inverted crediting system.
Yeah, well, we don't like the graphic for the front, so put the author's names on it. Let them be responsible for that. Okay.
That's awesome.
So I don't want to say the right thing happened in the end. I don't know, you know, but I mean,
well,
that's
I think if you're writing a book and it's not being published by Apple, it's totally fair to put your name on it as the author.
But it was never published by Apple. It was published by Morgan Kaufman. You know,
does Apple still have a press? I mean, I think at one point they used to.
No, it's not. Well, yes, they did. I think they used to have a press. Like this was Apple. Not an Apple press thing. Yeah. That's long
if you're going
enough.
Out through Apple press, fine, Apple. If you're not, well, it's kind of unfair, you know?
Yeah. Well, there had already been this had happened before with other people where they were writing books internal to Apple and they didn't get their names on it. I mean, you know, some people were unhappy about that, and I can understand that. And I just knew going in that we weren't going to have our names on it.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's it. I think we're like, once you know going in, well,
yeah,
you signed up for it. Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, that's exactly right. I had signed up for it, and that's, you know, okay. So anyway, I felt very gratified to have my name on it. And when I got one in my hands, you know, and I thought they did a beautiful job of printing it, and, you know, but Apple owns it all. You know, this isn't something I get royalties for, or, you know, I mean, it's Apple's book. And if I wanted to do a revision of it, I would have to work that out with Apple.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been asked by the publisher, did we want to do revision? Because it's older, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of good stuff you could put in it now.
Sure.
But the world's changed, you know, there's so much more information now out there about Apple, about the graphic system. Other people are doing some really fine work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a major project to update that book. I don't think that's coming anytime soon. I don't think I'm likely to do that. But I'm glad that it still, you know, has a lot of utility.
Yeah. Again, it's a terrific introduction to the, what I can't stop calling the PostScript imaging model. But is there a better name for that? PDF?
Well, the reason I think people refer to it as a PDF imaging model is because it's evolved in that it now has compositing kinds of operations built in, not the kinds of compositing that Next built into the, you know, to add to Display PostScript, but different kinds of different kinds of ways of blending graphics. That blends blend modes now. And so that's not something that ever got added to PostScript, and that actually adds a quite a lot of computational difficulty to you know, rendering the graphics. So I think it's you know, added another layer of sophistication, let's put it that way.
Yeah. So going, like, from now on, I should call it the PDF imaging model? That's your...
Well, I tend to say PostScript, but I'm an old, you know, it's PostScript PDF. I mean, the basics of the imaging model are still PostScript.
Right.
You know, but like
I mean, and to me, it's like that whole thing, you know, the origins in the lower left corner.
All of that.
You draw from the middle of a pixel, which was, you must remember when OS X shipped.
Yeah.
And everybody was going ape because they had to draw in the middle of a pixel to get like a 1 pixel thick line.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now with Retina screens, guess what, idiots? It's working pretty good for you now, isn't it?
Well, the real thing is, you know, just to mention, you know, in the early 2000s, and this is something Peter was trying to pursue, and I was so, so excited about the idea of high DPI displays. And I really thought, God, we are missing the boat. We have this great imaging model, and if we can push the displays to higher resolution, it's going to be a big selling point for Macintosh. You know, I really wanted to see that effort succeed. And I think really what happened is that just the hardware wasn't there. Maybe the displays were, it was going to be expensive for the displays. Maybe the displays were, but the GPU hardware, you know, just the stuff wasn't to the level that it needed to be to get the kind of performance, I guess. And it wasn't the big focus. Now, you know, Retina graphics is like, oh my God, you know, you use an iPad or you use a Mac. Yeah, it's just, you know, the quality of that stuff. Yeah. So fabulous. And they found a good way to do it, to not make all the developers to suffer greatly, which would have been the case if you'd had sort of more of a, instead of having 2x scale factor, if you had, you know, the possibility of 1x and
1.5 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant.
Yeah, like I like the idea of that, but it felt like it was never going to work.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I was like, oh, I really want to see this, but everybody was going to have to rework it. I mean, nothing was going to look good unless you ran it 2x. You know, it just wasn't going to look good. You know, there's too many difficult things. And I mean, if you look in the book, I had some stuff about that because I was anticipating that we were going to do this. And so, you know, in core graphics, there were routines, and I wrote some about it in the book about, you know, how to convert, because this is stuff you had to do in PostScript if you wanted. Sometimes you had to do this, you know, in your PostScript code if you wanted some of the graphics.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had
to figure out the width of a single line. You had to do a bit of.
Well, not just that, but if you wanted to like land your graphic and if you wanted to land your pen at the right place in the pixel in user space, you had to calculate it in device space and then transform it back into user space.
Right. Yeah.
So it was that kind of stuff. And they put in some functions in Core Graphics to let you do that. And, you know, there's a little bit of code in the book about how to do it. But it was going to be a lot of work for developers. And, you know, it's pretty much for free for most people. Yes, there are developers who were doing some things where they were doing some maybe pre-rendering off screen. Now,
yeah, I had a bunch of issues with an app.
You know, but people figured it out pretty quickly. And
Yeah. Well, also having sort of two modes, it makes it a lot nicer. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you don't have to figure out anything in between. One thing that is funky is having screens, like one screen at 2x and one screen at 1x.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gets a little crazy.
Well, you know, some of that...
You know, I've worked it out. So.
Some of that, you know, like with color management, that was another kind of thing because... Yeah. You know, there's a lot of code and there's a lot of stuff in Core Graphics to let you draw using color managed, you know, workflow. And well, hey, guess what? Your display color space is maybe different between the two displays you've got. Right. If you really wanted to do some careful work, you might have to take that into account. Hopefully not. Hopefully you draw in a calibrated space and it just all the matching's done for you. But people do a lot of things which aren't, and you can end up with some surprises.
Well, it's a very difficult problem space to solve elegantly, I think. And I think for, you know, mostly it's done really, really well on OS X and iOS.
In iOS, you have the benefit of not having a second display.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I don't just mean the color.
You mean the general problem.
I mean the general problem. If like an imaging problem is difficult. And I think it got nailed really well on OS X originally. And it scaled to the point that you can take that similar kind of approach and stick it on like the iPhone 1 and sort of the way that it renders on the host into a texture and then like composites it all. Was it like just a really forward-looking and very smart step to take?
You know, I think Apple, you know, when OS, the technologies that got built, at least in graphics and imaging, the technologies that got built into the OS, you know, in the early stages of OS X, absolutely led to what was possible on the iPhone.
Now except it led to most of the complaints, right? Because it's like, this draws like, you know, resizing a window just takes forever. And it's like, okay, just wait for it. Just give it a few years. I know it's going to be painful, but this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think, also people figured out some optimization. And people did figure out some of the live resize stuff. Some people figured out better ways to do it. But you're right, the hardware got a lot better. And, you know, I guess don't you think that if you design for today's hardware, then, you know, that maybe is the mistake.
It was incredibly optimistic.
Peter was an optimist, that's for sure.
I don't know if it was optimistic. It seemed like just the right thing to do. But I was doing a lot of GPU stuff, so I could really kind of tell what the intent was.
Let's just say an awful lot of developers weren't, and that was not an obvious thing at the time.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true. So so the most recent thing you worked on at Apple, I think, before you left was AirPrint.
Yeah.
I thought interesting. I was kind of surprised that you guys even brought printing to iOS for some reason. I don't know why. It seems so obvious now. So what was the impetus behind that?
Behind bringing printing or by AirPrint? As the printing solution.
I guess, both. I mean, once you decide to do printing, I think maybe AirPrint falls out naturally from that. Does that make sense?
I would agree with you, but I wouldn't say that was necessarily what everybody thought when we were first starting to work on it.
Okay. So that's okay.
I mean, at this point in time, it seems pretty obvious, but...
And I don't mean to diminish the...
Oh, no. I know you don't, Guy. I think you're right. It's just that, you know, some people have to agree, you know, because the first thing is why printing? That is harder to answer. Just, you know, to me, if you want, if you want these devices to have, you know, rich capabilities, that is one that you, I think, is pretty much a given. You know, I think there's some things that are missing that should be given that aren't there, like create PDF out of printing kind of thing like you have on OS X. But being able to print for a lot of people is really
a mass market feature.
It really is. And by the way, I know this is jumping ahead a little bit, but I'll just tell you, for me, like if my wife wants to print a photo, I say, get it on your iPad and print it from there. It's just so darn easy. I've got the 4x6 paper loaded in the printer here. She just prints and you get a really nice, it works out really well.
I know a lot of people who that's their standard answer now, and anyone in the family wants to print.
Yeah, which, you know, to me, in part, is a failing of OS X printing because, you know, iPhoto printing is way, way more complicated than it really needs to be for the common person. But anyway, so, you know, I think it's just part, personally, you know, look, I'm coming from a printing background, so I just sort of take it for granted that you want printing on a computing platform, which, you know, the iPhone and iPad are computing platforms. It's just they're disguised very nicely. So, you know, when we tackled the problem of how to do printing on the iPad and iPhone, one, or iOS, basically, the question is, well, you know, on the Mac, you don't even see it anymore because of the way drivers are delivered. They're all downloaded now. But historically, we ship gigabytes of drivers in OS X.
I mean, I was so angry at how many gigabytes I had to get for that. Yeah, there was an option, right? It was like, no, don't install drivers.
Yeah, and sometimes you could choose which manufacturers. I mean, there were all kinds of different scenarios, you know. I tried to stay as far away from that kinds of those kinds of things in printing as possible, you know. Yeah. I mean, anyway, so this was something that was having third-party code run as part of the OS as opposed to as a third-party app was something that was not really going to happen on iOS. I mean, it just wasn't. And so then you have the problem of, you know, well, how do you support any decent number of printers? You know, even if you said, okay, we're going to only support the printers from manufacturers XYZ, you know, the big three, Epson and Canon and HP, say. And even among their printer lines, you know, there's all kinds of, they had tons of different drivers for OS X just for their printers. So, you know, that just wasn't feasible. And we, on the team, thought that the only way to do it was really to say, okay, we're going to define how printing is going to work. From the point of view of the printer, not from the point of view of the user. We had a lot to do with that too, but AirPrint means two different things. I'll just say a little bit about it. AirPrint, it's a technology that Apple defined that we licensed, or they now, I don't work for Apple anymore, but Apple licenses to printer manufacturers. And basically, you build this technology into your printer, and then you're an AirPrint printer, and anything that can print to an AirPrint printer can print to your printer. And it, the idea was to have a communication protocol that defined how you're going to talk. It's a over bonjour for discovery, and IPP, which is called the Internet Printing Protocol, which is it's basically a control protocol for how you communicate the data to the printer and commands for what the printer is supposed to do. I don't mean the graphics that the printer is supposed to draw, but I mean, you know, you're supposed to print on this size letter paper or this kind of paper, letter A4, whatever. These features you're trying to turn on in the printer, quality modes and things like that. So there's that layer, and then there was the PDL kind of layer where JPEG is one of the graphics formats that you can send to the printer, because clearly when you're printing photos, you want to just be able to ship off the JPEG if you can. And PDF is one of the protocols that you can send PDF documents to printers that support it. That's not a requirement for an AirPrint printer, but that's one of the things. And then there was a raster graphics format that Apple defined that everybody had to support. So
is that a fixed pixel definition or?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, there's a couple different, it's basically a raster format with you know, certain couple bit depths that are potentially supported and a couple color models that are supported and compression scheme and stuff. But no, it's pixels.
Yeah.
If you're going to do vectors, you're going to do PDF.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically we had to get buy-in from Apple management to say, yes, we could build into iOS a printing system for which maybe there aren't very many printers when it first ships, because we're basically defining a new printer language, if you want to call it that. But it was the only real practical way to define a way for iOS to print. And it's turned out to be, I think, very successful. There's now a lot of printers from tons of manufacturers, including some you wouldn't expect for, you know, like Dell, for example, ships some AirPrint printers. I think almost all of HP's product line now, Canon, Epson, Brother, I mean, all these printer manufacturers, you know, now they're doing AirPrint, which is great, because the idea was, you know, you buy a printer, you don't have to think about whether it has this AirPrint or not. It just does.
It seems to me that this is kind of the way it just should have worked always.
There are those of us who feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
No, I agree with you. And you know what? We learned a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
We learned a lot in the 20, 25, 30 years, you know.
Right.
In some ways, PostScript was some of these things.
Yes.
Right? I mean, PostScript was sort of part of that. But it didn't have the control language. Control language, you know, I'm calling it control language, but
yeah.
The things that IPP allows, any feature support in PostScript was done through the PostScript language. It was connected to the PDL, which I think has some really negative effects. You know, the way
PDL is printer document layer, is that it?
Printer description language, I guess. Okay. Or no, it's, you know, PDL, I guess it's printer description.
The stuff you're going to print, basically.
Well, it's the, you know, like PostScript is a PDL,
yeah.
You know, PDF can be, you know, it's a PDL on the for AirPrint. Sorry. I'm just, you know how it is when you get used to these terms, you forget about.
No. It's like I knew what it was. I just don't remember what it expands to in any way.
Yeah. But no, we learned a lot over time, you know, and IPP didn't just show up, you know, for AirPrint. It was something that had been developed over a long period of time. And Mike Sweet, who, you know, works, who's now at Apple, has been at Apple for years now, but he's, you know, he's chair of the IPP, you know, it's an international standard, you know. And he's been formative in the development of it over time. And when Apple, you know, early days of OS X, we licensed software from Mike, whose company, Easy Software. He did this software called Cups, and we licensed it, and that became, you know, the server part of the OS X printing system, you know, which was
common Unix printing service. Yeah.
I don't know if it's service or sounds good.
System?
I thought of a system, but it could be either one.
Yeah.
Michael yelled at me later now.
But that, yeah. Now, you know what? Now I'm sure it's system. I think that gets built into OS 10.3, something like that. There's a switch over to it.
10.2.
Yeah.
We shipped Cups as the, and that's what enabled printer sharing, for example. You know, Cups was an implementation, but the actual, you know, language, so to speak, IPP, you know, that was the key part. And that was the part that, you know, every printer vendor that was doing an AirPrint printer now had to build IPP into their printer.
Right.
But it's been a huge win. And, you know, there's a lot more, I think, that Apple can do with it, with AirPrint. You know, so that's the printer side of it. The other side of it was the iOS or the Mac side, where we had to build client support in. And AirPrint, to people on iOS, AirPrint is sort of the printing system on the client side too. So
yeah,
you know, if you look at the APIs, I think people sort of look at that as AirPrint.
Yeah. So it's a mixed bag. So, but what it enables is pretty interesting, because you can get feedback from the printer, right? Like the printer could tell you what kind of paper is in there.
Yeah.
And then the client, being the iOS device, can format specifically for that paper.
Yeah, you know, one thing that was that was a really important part of building a simple to use printing system on iOS was there's not a lot of UI. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to build as much intelligence into the printing system itself so that the user didn't need a lot of UI in order to print. So if we know what kind of paper is in, you know, what size paper is in the printer, then we can communicate that to the app and the app can format for that size paper and the user doesn't have to choose a size paper. You know, and where there's multiple choices, for example, and this is already in iOS, there's multiple photo papers in your printer, then an app that's printing photos will give you a choice. You can choose which photo paper you want to print on.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And well, it's because an awful lot of printers, you know, it's a new, relatively new thing. Mm-hmm. It's part of IPP. It's part of what is in AirPrint. It's something, either you have to be able to configure the printer to tell us, or there has to be a sensor for in the hardware to know what type of paper, and that tends to be a more expensive solution. So at least if you can configure your printer to tell it what paper you've put in it, then it can report to the host. And geez, I mean, I don't want to have to pick a paper size, just print on what's in there.
Right. Yeah. That's just right.
I mean, avoid a lot of, you know, there's a lot of that. I mean, we tried to make the iOS printing system pretty smart in that regard. And AirPrint is a piece of that, trying to be smart, you know.
Well, it's a second shot at doing what, you know, the OS X printing system, right?
Yeah. And of course, you know, we support AirPrint printers on OS X too, you know, was something we added there too. So ideally you can plug in your printer and, you don't have to download any software at all. You know, it just works. And that's the way I run. That's the way I run here on at home as AirPrint, the AirPrint printers in the house.
Yeah. I do the same. Not that I print that often.
Me neither. My goal, you know, one thing I just wanted to say, you know, is I sort of feel like I happen to, you know, my career in working on printing systems and stuff, I feel like I just happen to be at the right place at the right time because, I mean, my personal opinion is I'd like to phase out printing. You know, I don't want to see a lot of pieces of paper. Mm-hmm. Adding save as PDF, you know, I hope that has already in OS X saved millions and millions of trees. You know, I mean, sending that to somebody instead of printing something and mailing it, you know, whatever. Printing.
I do that all the time. When like Safari has that nice feature, just save as web receipt.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of...
that's not Safari, by the way. That is...
Or it's the printing system.
It's the printing system. Well, I mean, Safari can do it, but that's why you're using it. But that's just a general piece of the printing system, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I just mean they have a menu item for it, and I'm sure it's like three lines of code. But yeah.
I'll tell Rich you said that. He'll be glad to hear it was only three lines. But anyway, that's exactly it, you know. Yeah. And I would like to see that in iOS as well. Not that specific thing, but just the ability to get PDF out instead of pieces of paper. So that I don't know. I felt like you know, in terms of leaving Apple, I'm personally hoping that printing becomes less important. And, you know, I think it has over time. And I don't mean that because I've left Apple. I mean because I just think the time has been coming for a long time. And hopefully, you know, we can build out more if necessary to make it less necessary to print. But, you know, my wife still prints all kinds of stuff, you know.
Yeah, I think it's still a common thing. But, you know. So it's one of those things that you hope like 15 years from now is kind of not common, right?
No, for generations of people, they want to hold it in their hand or it's not real.
I do actually, So the first developer conference I went to was in 1987. And what was going on at the time was Mac 2 had just come out. The Mac SE had just come out. You know, Steve was long gone. But I've pretty much been to every developers conference since. This is probably going to be the first year I'm not going.
Oh, too bad.
First of all, you guys on the East Coast have a big advantage.
Mm.
Did you go last year?
Yep.
I did. I don't know. I got lucky.
Likewise.
Renee, did you actually have a ticket, Renee?
I did.
You did. So, okay. You know, I used to go, so for my first, I'd say about 7 years at Apple, I used to go and I'd spend the week, well, when it was in San Jose, I could come from Santa Cruz and I'd just drive over every day. But when they moved to San Francisco, I would go up and I'd spend the week in San Francisco and I would go like anybody would go. Mm-hmm. And it was plenty busy at the developers conference, but I could still do that as an employee. I mean, not every employee could do this, but I really did try and have a developer focus as much as I could. And I wanted to, it's one way to learn about stuff you're not working on. Mm. You know, it's hard to find time to learn about all that other stuff when you're doing development in the company. Mm. So I loved the developers conferences. Now, of course, over time, they got so crowded. There's so much stuff. And as employees, we pretty much, the only part that we got to go to was if you were presenting or it was your team, was giving a talk. And then we had these labs, which I love the labs. I don't know if you guys tended to go to them.
Been to a few. I mean, there's a lot of value in those labs.
I really liked it. People would come and, you'd sort of get to talk one-on-one and they had a problem, which usually you could solve pretty quickly for them, which is nice. Or, there's some that are a lot more in depth or some you can't solve. But I like talking with the developers that came. So I went to an awful lot of the conferences, and then I'd say about the past maybe 4 years or so, it was pretty much you couldn't go. You just couldn't go as an employee. There is one thing here that I wanted to mention. And by the way, whether you guys want to use it or not, but I just think it was sort of funny because I did listen to your podcast with Grant Paul, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, I don't know the guy, but just to hear him talking about the jailbreak stuff. And one of the things that I remember was the early days of debuggers and stuff on the Mac, because in 85 timeframe or 84, 85 or whatever, you started with the two Mac debugger, which basically you had a Mac over here and you had another Mac over there. And one of the Macs was basically showing all your debug stuff while you're debugging your app. And it was all your debugging machine code and all of that. And then this really cool debugger came along called TMON. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Yeah, this is a long time ago. But TMON, all of a sudden, what you could do with the two Mac debugger, you could do on a single Mac. It's like you could drop into TMON, and it was I don't want to say windowing system. They had a funky sort of way of doing windows, but it was really, really cool. And this was like, but when I think back on what those things were like, machine code debugging only, the kind of, no windows really. It was just sort of window constructs and stuff. And I just thought, God, we had it so tough. And then I listened to this. And I listened to what this guy Grant is talking about with compiling his stuff on an iPhone.
Yeah.
And debugging it. And then he's talking about, I forget which game console, which, one run.
It was Nintendo Wii, he was saying. You could just break it.
You have to buy a new one. Well, he figured out how to fix that. But, he figured out how to make it so that this couldn't happen. You could revert. And I hear that, and I'm just like, oh, my God. I guess this is always true. It's always going to be, there's going to be some low-level crazy thing you have to do if you want to do some neat thing. And I just thought that was just so cool, what these guys are doing. So, it's like you sort of want to say, oh, we had it tougher in the old days. And then I'm going, well, these guys, they did a lot.
They got it pretty tough too. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, remember when Macs used to ship with a debug button?
Oh, that's what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about.
Okay,
you had the programmer switch you'd put on the side of your Mac, and you'd hit the switch, and it would drop into the debugger, and you'd look at whatever.
So yeah, that's what I mean. I've done. I've had to do that before, but I think I got my first Mac in like 95, 96, something like that. But I didn't know what it was called. It was just like, there's a programmer switch, and I kind of thought that was pretty cool. Not that I had used it for much, but I thought it was cool.
Oh, no. You had to install it on the side. I mean, you could reboot with it, but it had two buttons. The first, I think the front one was the reboot, and the back one was to drop in the debugger. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Crazy.
Really early on, You know, when the Mac first came out, there was no internet. There's email. How you got information about stuff and how you communicated with other developers was real, not just developers, the Mac community. You know, you waited for Macworld magazine to come out. You know, the next issue of Macworld. I just remember drooling, waiting for that next issue of Macworld.
Yep.
You know, and the ability to communicate with other people who were interested in Macintosh, you know, it was pretty much users groups. So I used to go to the Stanford users group, and they used to get some, you know, being around Apple, they'd get some pretty good people. I remember Bill Atkinson was the one I was particularly interested in, you know, because he was talking about QuickDraw, talking about Mac Paint, you know, just...
Yeah.
But one thing that was really cool and that played a huge role in my interest and ability to like get sort of booted into this community was a guy named Gus Fernandez, who I found out now works at Google. Gus started a little developer group that was sort of like a little subgroup of the Stanford users group. So if you're interested in development, you could come to that. And he got this parade of superstar people to come and talk. And, you know, it's like Andy Hertzfeld was obviously the big name that you would recognize. But Bruce Horn, who'd written The Finder, or was a co-author of The Finder. Bill Budge, who had been like a superstar Apple II guy. Larry Kenyon, who'd done, I think, the disk driver stuff for the Mac, maybe for the Apple II. Chris Crawford, who was a game developer early on. Yep. I don't remember the name of the program anymore.
I don't either, but he's...
He did a cool game. I just remember that.
I was such a fan of that guy coming up.
Is that right?
Yeah. I'm stuck on his name. I'm stuck on his title. But yeah, it was one of those guys that's like, man, I want to do what that guy does.
But I mean, I think these guys came and, you know, and it's not, you can imagine the developer group wasn't a huge group that came. It's not like the user group where you'd get hundreds of people or 100 or more people. This was, you know, like, a handful of people, you know, 20 people, maybe at the most. But Gus managed, I don't know how he did it. He managed to get like these superstar people from Apple or in the community, you know, in the community to come and talk to us. And it really was just so much fun to do, you know, to sort of touch that and to hear these guys talk. And of course, they were like gods at the time, you know, I knew nothing about any of this stuff. When the Mac first came out, somebody at Stanford started this mailing list, which, you know, was sort of a new thing, I think, at the time, because this is 84, and an awful lot of people didn't even have email. I mean, I had email because I was at Stanford. If you were at a university, you probably did, but it wasn't...
It was still like a UUCP style, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. And then I was at Slack, so we had a thing called BitNet that somehow connected us to the rest of everybody, and you had to know what sort of network people were on and stuff. Yeah. It was really pretty weird. But somebody started a mailing list at Stanford, and basically you would send in, you know, people would send in their information and it would be compiled into a big digest and it would get sent out. It was called the InfoMac Digest. And I met a lot of people through that. At one point I was moderator for that. So that just meant you just took mail messages that came in and you sort of used Emacs to paste them together. I mean, I'm not kidding. That's how I learned Emacs. You pasted it together into the digest and then you mailed it out to this mailing list of, you know, how many hundreds of people or whatever that wanted to get it every day. And I met a ton of people through that, including some people who later on ended up working with at Apple or other companies, like Darren Adler, who I know... Don Melton was talking a lot about, because Darren, super brilliant guy, and I worked with him at General Magic before I didn't work with him at Apple per se, but before he and I were both at Apple at the same time. But I met a lot of people through that, and we used to organize these things called Netters Dinners, which was, you know, when Macworld came around, which was like a big giant thing at the time, we'd all, you know, try and get together to have dinner. So all these people who you didn't know, but you met finally, you know, at some physical location. We went out to the Hunan restaurant, a big group of people and stuff. So, but it was really, I mean, that was like the connection to the community. Yeah. It was, you know, it's so different now and I love it now. It's so much more connected and it's out, what we did was so primitive, you know, compared to it, but it was really formative. It really made a difference in my life.
I'm sure. Well, I mean, because there's still that huge bonus, I think, of actually getting to meet people and
totally. No, yeah. That's
or,
why.
Or do this kind of thing, right? Like chatting and just kind
absolutely.
Of shooting the breeze. Yeah.
Well, that's why I said at the beginning, you know, when we first sort of started was, you know, Skype. Well, it's, you know, it doesn't work, man. But when it does, look what it lets you do. I don't, you know, exactly. Renee, you're in New York right now?
Yes.
And Guy, you're in Montreal?
Montreal, yeah.
He's getting much better bagels than I am right now.
What?
No, don't. He's going to start
be.
A fight.
Montreal's
known for...
in Montreal?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, good, no good. Way. You came down on the right side of that fight, so...
Wait. Better bagels in Montreal? I can't believe that.
Oh,
I will send you some, sir.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Yeah. Montreal bagels are awesome.
Wow.
There's places in New York that... Like they have people drive up here to buy bagels and bring them back in the morning.
And I'm not editing this part out either.
Yeah. No. It's all bagels all the time. This well, is it. This is actually how we're going to lead into the show.
Okay. That's bagel fine talk. With me. That's fine with me. I'm really impressed. I did not know that. I mean, so many people came back from Singleton conference and said wonderful, wonderful things about Montreal, which I've never been to Montreal, but I heard that and I'm like, wow, this must be an amazing place. But when you add bagels in,
We'll have
to find talking. To get you out here.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be very hard to do. The bagels wouldn't even be necessary, but that is an inducement. No, because, you know, I went to college on the East Coast and going to, you know, I did go to New York some, and those were the gold standard bagels.
Yeah.
And during the summer, I lived in Dallas as a teenager. And so in college years, I went home to Dallas during the summer. And I worked at a place that was like a chain that was coming out of New York called the Bagel Nosh. And they, you know, made pretty good bagels. They made water bagels. And I thought, okay, this is as good as you're going to get outside of New York City. It's just, and you come out here to California, forget it.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's just, you know, don't bother. If you have bothered, I'm sorry. But if you haven't, don't.
Yeah, we'll take care of you with on the bagel side.
Yeah. I think that, joking aside, I think it's basically there's New York bagels and there's Montreal bagels and then there's just everything else that doesn't count.
Yeah, there's Montreal bagels and there's New York bagels and there's everything else.